Go back to those gold sounds and keep my advent to yourself, because it's nothing I don't like. Is it a crisis or a boring change when it's central, so essential? It has a nice ring when you laugh at the low life opinions, and they're coming to the chorus now. I keep my address to yourself.
Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And I am Will Leach. And this is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 53 here at the New Republic. Grierson, you have just gotten back from Sundance, and you are back from Sundance for 24 to 36 hours before the world exploded again. That's a kind of a happening that's going on every weekend now. Everyone invest in your poster board and markers. You are going to need them for the next, I would say, 4 years. Could be a couple of months, could be a couple of weeks, could be 30 years. Who knows? But Grierson, you got back and you were at the first of the LAX protests in the wake of Donald Trump's Muslim ban. I was very envious that you were there, and I felt comparatively guilty because I was, as always, tied up with two very small people. What was the experience like that you were there? Did you feel like, to me, it was very exciting to see. I saw that you were there, and I sent you a text and said, "Way to go, Grierson." And then I looked at my phone 2 hours later, and there was a picture of you there, and they had gotten the stay of the ban. So good job.
I of course take no credit for that. No, I was actually at the downtown one on Saturday. Okay. They had a big one at LAX today, Sunday, but I was at the one downtown. We had about 300 or so people there, and I have to say, this is my first protest I'd ever been at. I never did one for the war against, or the war in Iraq. So it felt actually good because, as you mentioned, I was at Sundance last week. And so I missed the Women's March. I was in movies all day that Saturday. And so after seeing all those pictures, I felt like, you know, when I get back to Los Angeles, I really need to not just tweet about this. And so actually going out there with my wife, who's amazing, was really, I don't want to overstate it because, you know, who cares, but I did find it incredibly emotional and very moving. And frankly, I have to say that that's the first thing I've done since the election that actually made me feel better, just because I felt like I was actually doing something. It was a very small thing, but it still felt like actively saying, I am against this, and I am sort of standing up against it. In my own like small way, it felt meaningful, and so I was very happy that I did that.
Well, to me, I mean, I'm not going to credit you personally with this, but millions of people personally like you, frankly, seem to be making the difference already. So that is, everyone's going to keep it up. But again, it's now been 2 weeks and two massive nationwide protests. So as I said, everyone invest right now, invest in Sharpies. Everybody invest in Sharpies. Go long with Sharpies, because I feel like those are going to be in style. But welcome back, Grierson. I'm glad to have you back. I'm glad to have you back out there on the streets. So this is the Grierson Leach Podcast. All I'm going to do is always to subscribe to us on iTunes, find us on SoundCloud, and of course, thenewrepublic.com. Please email us at GriersonLeach@newrepublic.com, and make sure when you give us a review on iTunes, mention the name of a movie you would like to see, and we will review it in our reboot section. This week on the podcast, we have two reboot movies. The first of us comes from Peter FH375, fantastic film reviews, says Peter. Accidentally stumbled upon this podcast when I was searching for New Republic senior editor Brian Beutler's podcast on politics, which, by the way, is called Primary Concerns, which I recommend everyone listening to. It has a little bit more how you can make a difference and help, and is one of the, I had to purge a lot of political podcasts after the election just for my own sanity. That is not one of them. That and Pod Save America and the Slate Political Podcast are the ones that get me through everything. All three great podcasts. So listen to Brian Beutler's podcast. It's really good. So anyway, while he was searching for that, he ran across ours and says, "No offense to Brian, but Tim and Will are way more entertaining." I don't know if I agree with that. We're certainly not as smart. "Love the banter between these guys and the way they analyze films. Would love to see them review Memento, one of my favorite films from my high school years." So our first movie we'll be discussing is Christopher Nolan's Memento. written by John, off a short story by Jonathan Nolan. Anyway, and the second movie comes to us from William J.K. Krez. 5 stars, the best movie podcast around. I'm a longtime reader of their print reviews at Yahoo, Deadspin, and now the New Republic, and it's wonderful that they are now sharing their thoughts on movies via podcast. Their friendship extends back many years, and that familiarity and chemistry is evident in each of the podcasts. The highest compliment that I can pay them is that their podcast has broadened my view on how to watch movies, and listening to them has made going to the cinema more enjoyable. That is a very nice thing to say, William J.K. Krez.
Yes, thank you. Yes, that's very nice.
Thank you. But then he just goes into a lot of really disgusting, deeply personal stuff about you, Grierson. I'll just cut that part out. Just pretend you didn't. Yeah, just don't go to iTunes, Grierson. You don't want to know. But good God, I mean, that's really just repulsive. I mean, I didn't even know a person could do that to themselves. Regardless, I'll move on. The reboot section is my favorite part of the podcast. I'd love if you two could review a classic movie of the 80s that is a family favorite. Trading Places, based on your review. Trading Places, based on your review of Fletch and Weekend at Bernie's. I know that slapstick 80s comedies aren't necessarily your favorite film, but I'm hoping you're willing to tackle this one. So we will be discussing, in addition to Memento, we will be discussing Trading Places. Now we're going to get into, also this week we'll be discussing the one big new release, I put big in quotes, which is Gold, starring Matthew McConaughey. We'll be discussing that briefly, but first I want to wrap up very quickly, Grierson. Your time at Sundance, you are back. Two major questions for you. First off, Sundance-wise, you know, last year was a big Sundance year, even though the biggest Sundance movie ended up not having the impact people thought it was going to. Definitely a big Sundance year. How, quality-wise, as a whole, will this be like a memorable Sundance year? Will this be one they'll go back and be like, oh, Sundance 17, we'll never forget that one? Or will they really just kind of remember it for, really, maybe for the Women's March Day?
I think it's still too early to tell, but I do feel like right now Sundance 2017 is going to be that was the year that Trump got inaugurated. I still feel like that's going to be the story when we look back. There were some good movies, but there don't seem to be as many as in past years where you had like a Manchester by the Sea or an Upstream Color, something where people were really fighting about, having these kind of like divisive opinions about, or really kind of like loving to death. The closest I think this year's festival had was Call Me By Your Name, which I think is the best thing at the festival, kind of by a wide margin. But this doesn't seem to be like a collection of great movies that came out of this year's. Some good ones, but not great ones.
Okay, so you took away my second question. So that was the best movie. You said that was generally considered to be the best movie. Was that what you consider, by no question, you think it was the best movie?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that by consensus, the movies that people tended to like were Call Me By Your Name, A Ghost Story, which I also think is great, Marjorie Prime, which was a little more divisive, but some people really love it. I was a little bit, I was just disappointed because I really wanted to see it. It didn't fit into my schedule. Even the movie that won the grand jury prize, I don't feel, oh God, what's it called? I don't feel at home in this world anymore, whatever it's called, the film by Macon Blair, who's been in Jeremy Saulnier's movies, that won the grand jury prize. And even that one was well-liked, but not necessarily loved by a lot of people. So, you know, I think what the advantage of a festival like this year's is that there's going to be a lot of room for people to discover things out of the festival. It's not going to be last year where there's so much hype for Birth of a Nation or Manchester by the Sea or whatever that it can create this kind of like impression that, oh, well, let's see if these movies are as great as people have said they are. Instead, I think people will discover things and go, oh, this one was a little under the radar, but it's really good. And in some ways, I actually kind of prefer a festival that's like that, because that way it gives, I think, viewers more of a chance to make those movies their own, as opposed to them feeling like they're being imposed on you. Like, this is a masterpiece. You have to go see this. There just weren't that many movies like that at this year's Sundance.
So when this year, there was a lot of hay made out of Amazon getting its first Oscar nomination with Manchester by the Sea, which debuted at Sundance. In your eyes, is there a Best Picture nominee in 2018 from this year's Sundance Film Festival?
I think Call Me By Your Name is the closest. It was picked up by Sony Pictures Classics before the festival. And I'm sure that they are going to push very hard for its best picture chances. That's probably the only, I'm trying to think about the slate, but yeah, I think that's as close as a best picture nominee. Mudbound, the new film from Dee Reese, who previously directed Pariah, that has a chance. I'm not as confident of that movie's sort of Oscar chances, though.
Okay, so no major breakaway. Like last year, Birth of a Nation was the explosion out of Sundance, and for various reasons, I think the clearly a lot of the personal stuff with Nate Parker was probably the primary driving reason of that. But for a lot of reasons, that faded by the end of the year. But there's no rocket ship out of Sundance like there was last year.
No, I think the closest you might get is two films actually that I missed at the festival. One is a documentary called Step. About an African-American dance troupe. People who saw that movie really loved it. And then in the dramatic competition, there was a film called Patty Cakes, which is a hip-hop-themed coming-of-age drama. The consensus out of the festival is that, you know, the story's kind of conventional, but the music is really great and the spirit of the movie is really fun. That's kind of as close as I think that you were going to have to a big, like, sensation out of the festival.
All right. All right. So, and then the last thing I want to ask you, didn't see Nobody Speak, right? That's the big documentary about the Gawker Hogan case. You didn't get a chance to see that?
No. One of the things, just in general, I try to avoid documentaries if I can out of the festival because I go to True False every year in March. And so a lot of times, some of the more kind of high profile documentaries of Sundance will find their way to True False. So I kind of strategically leave those to the side. But I was very curious about Nobody Speak. And it seems like people liked it out of the festival. But because of ours, and especially, of course, your close connection with Gawker and, of course, Deadspin, I'm both curious and anxious about watching it.
Yes, it's going to be weird. It's one of those strangest things is getting older, is realizing that like the things that happen in your life sometimes like are known by other people. And it's weird. It's weird. It's like making the TV happen. So that's Sundance. When do you go to True False?
I go the first week of March.
All right. So that'll be the next time. I'm sure we'll have plenty to chat about them if we have the opportunity. All right. So we're going to get in right into the movies this week. Our one main review this week is Gold.
Oh, mama, I'm in fear for my life from the long
arm. Baby, where are you going?
This gold business broke me off years ago. But it's amazing how little gold does can just change everything.
Damn it, Kenny.
All right, gold. Gold. Yar.
I feel like we should do that. Gold. Yayo.
Gold. Yeah. Goat, make gold. Gold. Stars Matthew McConaughey, directed by Stephen Gagan? Gagan? I said this wrong last week, too. What is it, Grierson?
It's Gagan.
Yeah, okay. Well, Gagan. Stephen Gagan. Stephen Gagan, who, of course, wrote Traffic and Syriana. He directed this film. It is about a man named Kenny Wells, or Matthew McConaughey, as balding with a paunch and just so one of the many things that is going on in this movie that kind of irks me is I think Matthew McConaughey is fine in this movie, but there's this every single time you see him like looking fat or looking particularly disgusting, you can almost see him winking at the camera, almost like, don't worry, I'm going to look good for my next movie. Don't worry. This is not who I generally am. Like there's a little wink that you kind of get from him that I think speaks to kind of this movie's desperation a little bit. But anyway, so he plays Kenny Wells, who is a prospector, and unfortunately this movie does not take place in the 1840s, though I might enjoy it a little bit more if it did. But he is a prospector in the 80s, where he kind of goes around looking for mines. It's his family business. Craig T. Nelson, or Coach, plays his father, who kind of and he takes over his business and kind of runs it into the ground a little bit. So until he's at his wit's end, he's almost completely out of money, he's living with the most thankless girlfriend role in recent memory, played by Bryce Dallas Howard, who is kind of the patron saint of thankless girlfriend roles. He's living with her. She's a waitress. He's completely down his luck. But he remembers this guy named Michael Acosta, who is played by Edgar Ramirez, who is a kind of a thought of as a genius guy for knowing where gold is. They find a place in Indonesia, and he wakes up. He gets malaria, and he wakes up, and it turns out, hey, Edgar, Acosta says, we found gold, and he gets rich, and then off we go. And it turns out the rest of the movie is Matthew McConaughey and his company of prospectors, including the guy from Jeremy Saulnier's movies.
Yes, the aforementioned Macon Blair is one of the cast of this movie, yes.
Yes, exactly. He's got Emma Stone eyes. He's got like very big eyes, that guy. I kind of like him. Anyway, so nothing to do here. But they end up running on like how they figure out. Then it becomes kind of what I would think would be a traditional 80s story where he gets a lot of money and then he runs into the inevitable temptations, kind of the Boogie Nights, Goodfellas, all sort of cycle. That's the way I thought this movie was going. And I frankly would have appreciated that kind of narrative flow. One of the many problems with Gold is it is all over the place. It is completely all over the place. I don't know the production history of this movie, but this movie has so many starts and stops. And so many go in this direction and pull back. And you can see when you watch the movie that there was a time where you could see where they were going, why they saw the story of, which is based on a true story, why they saw this story and thought, oh, that would make a good movie. Michael Mann was attached to this at one point. Spike Lee was attached to this at one point. Lots of interesting directors were attached to this movie. No offense to Stephen Goggin, Gagin, Gogan, but he does not get to, like, you feel like that kind of really part of the movie, that the key pivot of the movie, what this movie could have been about, could have been this satire about finance, could have been this kind of parable about greed. He kind of misses that because the movie is so kind of disheveled and disorganized. And in a lot of ways, it really, because it's kind of all over the place, it kind of a lot of times sits back and is like, yeah, just do your thing, McConaughey. And he's fine, I guess, but there's so little character that he's playing. I find his character actually not particularly interesting, other than the fact that Matthew McConaughey is playing him and he is fat and bald. The movie is just all over the place in a way that I found ultimately pretty frustrating.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt as well about the movie. What's interesting is that, well, I guess to back up, a few years ago, I did a book of interviews with different screenwriters, and Stephen Gagin was one of the people I interviewed in the book. And so I, you know, spent some time with him and found him to be a very smart, interesting guy talking about writing, how he approaches writing. And for me, one of the big question marks of this movie is that, you know, I'm assuming that he worked on the script a little bit, but he's not credited as one of the writers of the movie. That's Patrick Massett and John Zinman are the two screenwriters of the movie, because it doesn't feel like this movie doesn't have the elements, I think, that are what make Gagin's movies so interesting. You know, like you said, he wrote Traffic and won the Oscar for that, but he also wrote and directed Syriana. And he's good, I feel like, in terms of working with like big ensemble stories and different kind of storylines at the same time. And Gold just sort of feels like somebody, I don't know who, had the idea of, let's do something that's kind of like American Hustle, but not very convincingly. But let's just make sure that Matthew McConaughey has hair as embarrassing as the Christian Bale character in American Honey. Like, that seems to be kind of the inspiration. And I think also for me, like, this is one of those movies where Weinstein kind of dumped this movie. It was supposed to have like an Oscar run at the end of last year, but it kind of sort of did, but it sort of didn't. And it just feels like a movie that I'm not sure what the overall point of it is. As close as I could get was to sort of speculate, I guess, forgive the pun, speculate that I think McConaughey's character is supposed to be this kind of like modern day prospector, like you were sort of saying. Like, in some ways, he's supposed to be like, you know, the Daniel Day-Lewis character in There Will Be Blood or something like that, but he's like in modern times and what that would look like. But also because it's the 80s, it's almost sort of like a Wall Street sort of movie in a kind of way. And I guess what's interesting about the movie is that McConaughey plays a guy that you are, it's not even like you're supposed to think, oh, he's so dastardly, he's fun to hate. The McConaughey character is actually kind of pathetic. Like, he's just sort of a pathetic loser in an unredeeming kind of way. And so I guess I give McConaughey some credit for sort of honoring how pathetic that character is. But the problem is, I think when you play a character like that, if that's all they are, is they're just kind of pathetic and they're trying to show people, it's hard, I think, to be very invested in that story. And so I think for me, this just feels like a movie that's a bit of a flat line. It's not terrible. I just found myself consistently thinking, I'm not nearly as interested as I probably should be in what's happening right now.
Yeah, and you know, also there is, one of the things that's funny about it is, I talked about how it doesn't have that through line of guy gets rich, but then learns that gets too greedy and then falls from grace, which is, you know, we've seen that plot line in so many movies. But one of the things I thought was interesting, I wrote this in my review for The New Republic, you know, remember back in the 80s, there were all these movies that either started like Tom Cruise, Michael J. Fox, or Charlie Sheen. And they were someone, they were a young kid that came in and came from Kansas or wherever, went to New York and tried to make their living. We saw this in Weekend at Bernie's. Like every damn 80s movie all seems to be about this idea of the consumption of wealth. And that's the goal. Like there's no, like that's the idea. And then the 90s came around and usually only the bad guys were really obsessed with, were greedy and were trying to get money. I just felt like there was some sort of cultural moment that we have come back all the way back around to where the goal of the movie is not to, the main character's drive in movies is not, I want to do this thing, and also if money comes with it, that's great. We've come back to kind of the 80s where Tom Cruise is a bartender, or Michael J. Fox is confused with this person, has to impersonate somebody else. The consumption and wealth and greed is in fact the driving influence of plots now. It feels like it's come back around a little bit. I found a little bit depressing in this movie. Another thing, I'll kind of close on this. I really don't think there's too much more to talk about this movie. Bryce Dallas Howard. We've talked about many times about the kind of thankless female roles in movies. I think this is like an all-timer. Like it's the one thing that kind of stands out in this movie for, I agree with you, like kind of a basic, not particularly exciting movie, but one way or the other. But this is a Hall of Fame thankless girlfriend performance. She has two roles. She is either supportive, rubbing his head, letting him know she believes in him, or upset that he's lost in touch with who he is. And then she goes back to the first person again. This is a classic. And also, she is wowed by him, even though the character is not particularly wowing.
Yeah, I do like her better here than in Jurassic World, though, I will say. Because I actually think that her, I think that this character is more kind of fun. I mean, to go back to the American Hustle thing, she also is a character who has like big hair and like acts in this like kind of overly quirky, colorful kind of way. I'm very selective with my Hall of Fame candidates, you know, so I don't want to be
You're a small hall.
I am small hall. What can I say? And so for me, it's just like, oh, both of their performances, I felt the same way while watching them. Like, I kept thinking, well, that's an interesting choice. And that's just, also in terms of interesting choices, I want to end on this. Bruce Greenwood's accent. What's up with that? Bruce Greenwood's one of those character actors who, when he shows up in movies, I'm always like, hey, Bruce Greenwood. And when he opened his mouth, I thought, wait, is my hearing going? Like, no, he's doing an accent.
Yes. Another wasted Corey Stoll, by the way. I think Corey Stoll is a fascinating actor. I love like watching him and everything. And this is another fourth or fifth movie to row, including the last Woody Allen movie, where I'm like, man, someone's got to give him something to do. Because I think he's an excellent actor that has nothing really to do here. All right. I don't have anything more to say about Gold, do you?
I give it a C and I'm done.
Yeah, I gave it a C as well. We both gave it a C.
Oh, Mr. McConaughey. Remember the McConaughey Renaissance? It's gone now.
I'm wondering if the Dark Tower is like, he's filming that now. That's probably the hope, I guess, if he can pull off the Dark Tower. I mean, it was funny. There was even a stretch there where he was hitting on everything. Like to this day, I mean, it still amazes to me, and this is the last thing I will say here on this movie. I was, during today, I was at the Atlanta Hawks New York Knicks game that went four overtimes with my two children. We did not make it to the end because one of them is two. And they play over the loudspeaker his thing from Wolf of Wall Street, that thing where he pounds his chest. That is now somehow inexplicably become an arena sports thing. The former St. Louis Cardinals catcher Tony Cruz once had that as his at-bat music. Now imagine if you were sitting in a stadium of 50,000 people and all of a sudden out of nowhere you hear like you would think that Bane had taken over the place for crying out loud. So it is amazing to me that Matthew Connolly was at one point so hot that his guttural utterances were becoming arena rock songs at sports events.
I just feel bad for Jack White because that's cutting into his residuals.
I know. I don't think he has a crossover into Zambia. Like, I watched a World Cup qualifier one time, but like Zimbabwe's game was like playing Seven Nation Army. I'm like, all right, good for you, Jack. Now you can go make an album with the theremin or something, or whatever weird thing you've cooked up in Nashville. It's probably time for us to move on. Grierson, I think we should discuss our next movie, our first reboot movie. Our first reboot film this week is Memento.
Remember Sammy Jankis?
I met Sammy through work.
Insurance, I was an investigator.
I'd investigate the claims to see which ones were phony.
I had to see through people's bullshit.
It was a useful experience, because now it's my life.
But when I meet someone, I don't know if I've met them before. I have to just look in their eyes and try and figure them out.
Memento premiered at Venice in 2000, but most of us saw it in 2001. It is not the first film from director for Christopher Nolan. That was actually following. But for most of us, this was the first movie we'd ever seen from him. And going back to watch it this week for the reboot segment, I am reminded again that it is the perfect, ultimate, kind of ideal version of a Christopher Nolan movie. It stars Guy Pearce, just a few years removed from L.A. Confidential, as a guy named Leonard, who is an insurance investigator who is trying to hunt down the person who murdered his wife. For people who don't remember, but I'm sure most of you do, the movie, eventually we realize, is being played backwards, essentially, because he has short-term memory loss. He knows who he is. He knows what he's about. He knows what his job was and that he was married. But any type of new memories, he is unable to retain. And so he has to put tattoos all over himself, write notes, take Polaroids of the people that he meets so that he can essentially create a series of memories so that he knows what's going on as he's trying to hunt down the killer of his wife. He also stars Carrie Ann Moss as sort of the femme fatale character, Joe Pantaleone, as someone who Guy Pearce thinks he's not supposed to trust, but he doesn't know why exactly. I already kind of let the cat out of the bag in terms of how I feel about this movie. I loved it back in 2001. It was my number one movie that year. It's still pretty goddamn tremendous, I have to say. And it's funny to watch this movie now because I think that as Nolan's career has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, one of the knocks on Nolan has been, well, you know, his movies are very clever and they've got these cool twists and they've got these really, you know, kind of mind-blowing premises, but they're not very emotional. Well, I have to say that actually watching Memento this time, I thought all of that was true in terms of how clever the premise was and how perfectly put together the movie was. You know, when you watch a Nolan movie, you always are reminded how smart it is, and also, frankly, that Nolan wants you to know how smart his movie is. But in this movie, it works really well. But at the same time, I do think the emotional undercurrent of the film is actually pretty darn strong. It's this idea about, well, frankly, what a lot of Nolan's movies are about. They're mostly about guys who think that they have some sense of control over their lives, partly because they're trying to get over something horrible that's happened to them in their past, only to find out that, in fact, they actually can't control the things that are bothering them, and that those things will kind of rear their ugly head by the end of the movie. This was a time when Carrie Ann Moss was sort of looked at as being kind of a big deal. She had just been in The Matrix the year before. Then she was in this. She, I think, is actually really underrated in this movie. There's a lot of kind of feeling that comes from that character, somebody we don't know if we're supposed to trust or not. And she plays that sort of femme fatale role really nicely. And I think just in general, though I really love The Dark Knight, I think some of his other movies that Nolan's done, I think The Prestige is fun, and some of his other ones, this does sort of feel like the ideal Nolan vehicle. It does everything that he has done since then really, really well, but it's in this sort of like stripped down indie feel. Watching it this time, I thought, this is a lot more almost like gutter punk version of Christopher Nolan that I kind of remember now from recent years. I think the cast is all great. I will say, before I hand the mic to you, Will, that the thing I most enjoyed, though, about watching this movie was realizing why Thomas Lennon is in The Dark Knight Returns, or Dark Knight Rises, because he actually plays the Doctor in this movie and also plays the Doctor in Dark Knight Rises. And I thought, what a weird reference to Memento I had never caught until I went back and saw this movie.
Yeah, I did not realize that either. I feel like the state was probably on at this point. This was probably when he was still in the strike zone of it. But yeah, Memento is, it's funny, you know, one of the, apparently if you have a certain DVD, so they play the movie in order.
Right.
And I'd have no interest in watching that, but it's funny because, you know, having seen the movie before, I think I actually saw the movie a couple years ago. It hasn't been that long since I saw it. But one of the things that was fun about this is because I know where it's going, because I'd seen it recently enough that the movie didn't have like a lot of plot surprises to me. I generally remembered everything that happened. I knew where it was going or where it had come from, I guess is the case maybe. So what was fun for me was like, actually, because there was not a lot of surprise, was actually tracking back the jigsaw puzzle of it and having that kind of fun in real time. Roger Ebert famously in his review of this said he liked the movie, but he said the movie lacks rewatch value because once you figured out the trick and you know the ending, you never need to watch it again, which is like, we all love Roger Ebert. This is one of the more wrong things he's ever said. It is very enjoyable to go back and watch this. And one thing I really did this time that did not do a lot when I originally saw it was to really kind of, you know, this is a classic go back and have some fun fan theories movie. There's a lot of ideas of it. And particularly once you get to the end, and we're talking about Memento, so we're all spoilers and just deal with it. But once you get to the idea, there's a few little seeds tossed in there, like how much, like, was he Sammy Jenkins all along? Was there, like, there's the brief flash where you see Stephen Tobolowsky in the rubber room. That's a rude way to put it, but certainly in the context of the movie. And then you flash quickly and you see Guy Pearce. There's a little bit of that, the idea of like how much of this happened. There is the idea of this is the ultimate unreliable narrator movie in a way that's deeply, deeply entertaining. But it's funny because the thing about this is I can imagine people that first saw it, and you can go back and read some of the reviews, it felt like an experiment or a gimmick movie to a lot of people. But I think it's just because they didn't know Nolan yet. I think now that you know Nolan, this is, you talked about like the kind of male hero. This is like really a tortured, like all of his heroes are kind of tortured by their past in some way or the other. And it's funny though, because one thing that I like about this, I think his last couple movies have lacked a little bit. It's actually pretty funny. There's actually some like really funny moments in the movie. I had the same big laugh that I did the first time I saw the movie. He was like, okay, I'm chasing this guy. Oh, wait, this guy's chasing me. And like, it's very, very, like, that is such a great little moment of dark humor in the movie that's very sharp. And the movie has, it feels, you know, it's funny, one of the things with Nolan that I feel like he's lost a little bit in his last couple movies, so I've liked them, not as much as you have, but I've liked them a little. They seem to be getting more and more self-serious. So one of the things I like about this movie is, you call it gutter punk. It does have a little bit of, you know, we talked about this with Bottle Rocket a little bit. You can tell that it has come a little bit. This has still got a little bit of 90s dirt on it, you know, and in a good way. And I think in a really kind of positive way. There's a couple scenes, maybe it's with Carrie Ann Moss's boyfriend who kind of looks like that kind of hairy guy that was always getting shot in 90s movies. But like, there's a little bit of that like dirt. The movie's got dirt under its fingernails in a way that his recent movies, even the ones I like, don't feel that like they do. It is smart, and I think it's profound, and it's got some like real depth to it, but it also is fast on its feet in a way that, again, I'm not ripping. I still like The Dark Knight more, for what it's worth, because I feel like the scale is so kind of grand in that. I feel like that Dark Knight is like three or four great movies at once. This is one really great movie at once. So I think Dark Knight's a little bit above it. But I do like the fact that this feels It does. It's just it's got some grime on it in a way that I really enjoy.
Yeah, and when you said about that this movie is really funny, I agree. I thought you were going to mention I don't feel drunk, which is also right, yes. Which is also the other great laugh line in this movie. But no, not only is it funny, I think what's great is that the movie sort of has a hey, this is a fun premise to it. There is a bit of a sense that even though it is serious in certain ways, that the movie is kind of enjoying the trick it's playing, and that Guy Pearce's performance also plays into that. That there is a certain sense of, yeah, this is about the power of memory and how unreliable memory is and all of that. But Pearce is kind of having fun. I mean, you know, the movies he's made since then, like the you know, the classic Matt Singer title, Space Jail. Those movies, I think, kind of overstate the tongue-in-cheekness, where this one, I think, gets it exactly right. But for me, what's fun now watching Memento is you go, oh, he's gonna do this. Like, no one's going to do this over and over again. I had forgotten this movie was actually shot by Wally Pfister, who is a cinematographer for most of Nolan's career. But not just that, like, the music sounds like a Hans Zimmer score, even though Hans Zimmer didn't do it. Some of the way that, even like sort of like shot selections and a kind of idea about following a guy who is consumed on a quest. I mean, that is every single Nolan movie. I mean, this movie and Inception are so similar. I hadn't even thought about it because I am legally obligated to mention my love of Shutter Island at least once every 4 or 5 podcast episodes. Watching it this time, I also thought a lot about Shutter Island, not a Nolan movie, but this idea again about men who think that by solving a crime, they're going to fix something. I was struck by how much these two movies have in common. And with both movies, I think the argument is, oh, well, once you know the twist, it doesn't much matter. I'd say in both these movies, they reward multiple viewings because you see a guy trying to wiggle free of a riddle that they're never going to get out of. And especially in Memento, they actually don't want to get out of. I think that's the thing that's most profound in Memento is this idea of the Guy Pearce character actually really doesn't want to solve the crime, because solving the crime means coming to some sort of resolution, and this idea of grieving or having to come to the end of that, he isn't able to do. So, yeah, I say of the reboot movies we've done, this was probably one of the happiest, like, oh, thank God, this movie's still really tremendous. I'm still really happy how good this movie is, yeah.
I also love that even with all this, he still gets as whatever damaged he may be and how much he might want to not want to deal with really what's happened to him or what he's really done to himself. There's still some sort of satisfaction if even in the moment he turns himself into a bomb, which is basically what he does at the end of the movie or the beginning of the movie, where he has that moment like, oh, I need to make sure I set myself up that I kill this guy. Like, there's something very dark about that idea too, of the notion that even you think about what he remembers or what he doesn't remember, the idea that even at that moment where he's like, I hate this person, I'm going to step away to murder this guy, is something that is that people try to make him into a weapon, but he also is in fact his own weapon and is aware of that as well. It's a, like, he's not a good guy. and he's tortured, and there's a lot, and I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but I do like that there's almost a weird, for all this guy is put through and all of his problems have, there's almost a weird moment of triumph at the end of the film that he's like, you know what, I don't have any control over this, but this is one thing I can control. I can make sure at some point I move myself in this direction to kill this person.
Yeah, and also I, as you know, how much I love The Dark Knight 2. The thing I think they have in common is that both of their endings have this, like, gasp sense to them of, oh, no, that's what the character is going to choose. And it's a surprise at the end in both movies. But when you think back on it, it makes total sense why they do what they do. It's nice to go back and see this movie and be reminded how good it is. I will say... it does make me lament some of Nolan's more recent movies even more, because they do feel, we've talked about this before, but I think it's worth repeating, I think that he has gotten stuck in this idea of how smart and how epic his movies need to be now, that they've lost some of that, what is so simple and perfect about this film. And so I'm really curious, because Dunkirk does not feel like a puzzle movie. It doesn't feel like the movies he's made. And so I'm curious if that will be a nice break for him, or if it'll just continue to create this problem of, I need to make epic films, because, you know, for me, Nolan is like Paul Thomas Anderson and David Fincher. Like, these are kind of like the big kind of, you know, big English language filmmakers, you know, and Paul Thomas Anderson kind of does his own thing every time. David Fincher works in the studio system, but he kind of does his own thing, making big movies and sometimes smaller movies for himself. Nolan's like the one guy who really seems like he wants to be like the like blockbuster box office behemoth. Watching Memento, I miss the old Nolan in certain ways.
Yeah, I understand that as well. But nevertheless, Memento, by all means, it's, if you haven't seen Memento in a while, maybe you don't remember the ending as well, or maybe you don't remember it as recently. I think either way, this is a movie that is, I think, a pretty great movie, but also incredibly watchable, even if you've just seen it. So, yeah. So by all means, so go see Memento. One of our, as you said, one of our many happy reboot movies where we're like, oh, yep, still great. This movie is still very great. All right, so that is our first reboot section. Our second movie is Trading Places.
What in heaven's name is going on here?
He tried to rob the payroll, Randolph. He attacked me in broad daylight.
I didn't do nothing, man. This guy bumped into me.
I did not. You knocked me down and tried to grab my briefcase.
Yeah, but it was an accident, man.
An accident? Really?
What's going to happen to this man?
We're going to book him on assault, attempted robbery, and resisting arrest.
Well done, Winthorpe.
Hey, man, I'm innocent. This guy bumped into me. I was trying to give him his briefcase back to him. Shit, I can't be going to jail because I'm ass wiping, watching where he's going.
All right, Trading Places came out in 1983, which means it was filmed when Eddie Murphy was 20 years old, which is crazy because it also wasn't even his first movie. We forget just how much of a bolt of lightning Eddie Murphy was, and this was kind of, it's probably definitely the last time that he would ever be credited under Dan Aykroyd, that's for sure. The Trading Places came out in 1983, directed by John Landis. And if you did not know that, just wait for the See You Next Wednesday movie poster, which is, of course, he famously always gets See You Next Wednesday from 2001, correct?
Maybe.
Yeah. I think so. I think it's an ode to Kubrick.
That is a piece of Kubrick trivia I am unaware of.
Okay, well, here it is. Well, I will go ahead and read this for you now, Chris. But Landis got the title, See You Next Wednesday. It is from the 1968 movie 2001 Space Odyssey. It's the last line spoken by Frank Poole's father during Poole's video phone conversation with his parents. And John Landis has made sure to get See You Next Wednesday in every single one of his movies since then. A little piece of trivia for you, Chris.
I am duly impressed.
So anyway, so John Landis directed this, directed Trading Places, starring Eddie Murphy and Dan Aykroyd. It is a, you know, it basically the plot is Dan Aykroyd is a very, very obscenely wealthy banker for Duke and Duke in Philadelphia. Eddie Murphy is a homeless man who they come across each other at some sort of a Dan Aykroyd thinks he's being robbed. And then we meet the Duke brothers, Don Amici and Ralph Bellamy, who decide they are going to have a wager. They're going to have a social experiment to see if, for the bet of $1, if they can take Eddie Murphy and make him into a banking superstar, and Dan Aykroyd make him into a criminal just by manipulating their life's circumstances. One of the things that we always talk about in the reboot section are movies. We got a question about this actually in our mailbag show. Are movies that you would like to see remade? Now, Trading Places is a incredibly well, like it's been a hugely successful movie. Apparently, did you notice? I learned from the Wikipedia page. Trading Places is a Christmas staple in Italy. Like the local Italy, they play it like A Christmas Story. In Italy, did you know this?
You are blowing my mind with your Trading Places trivia today. I did not know that.
No. It's a great Wikipedia. Great movie to Wikipedia. All sorts of fascinating stuff in there. So anyway, so this is like a movie, like this is a well-regarded, well-thought-of movie. People have seen, you say Trading Places, everyone's seen Trading. I mentioned it to my wife. She's like, oh my God, I've seen the movie like 100 times. But of course, not in like 20 years. So for me, my takeaways from Trading Places, so that it's a movie that today, one of the questions they asked was like, if you were to remake a movie today, a movie with a great premise, Trading Places is a movie whose premise I think would be very valid today. The idea of are some people born into wealth, the privilege of a certain amount of wealth, and some people not having the opportunity, if you were to switch them and give that opportunity. I would love to see this movie remade in today's sensibility, which would be to say a little bit less blackface.
but not entirely no blackface, just a little bit less, right?
I think a lot less.
50%. How about
that? Let's just go with none. Let's just stick with that. There's literally, and again, I know the world has changed a lot since 1983, so I'm not trying to, we talk about this with a lot of these reboot section. We don't want to be be social justice police on every single one of these old movies. Not everybody knew the way the world was supposed to go. But I swear to God, Grierson, when Dan Aykroyd shows up at the end of this movie in blackface, I gasped. I literally like almost fell out of my chair. I was like, no, my God. Like I was staggered by it. So that is worth keeping in mind. Blackface alert in Trading Places. It is a shocking thing. So my overarching thing about the movie, there's some stuff that works in this movie. You can see why this movie was a hit. Namely, to me, Eddie Murphy is just a thunderbolt in this movie. Even when he's playing a, frankly, again, I would say now, like kind of an offensive character for a while, he is such, there's such like just crackling energy coming off of him that is just fun to watch him when he was just bouncing off the screen and everybody else is just kind of like trying to catch up with him while he's still, because one thing, another thing I like about Eddie Murphy's performance in this movie too is once he becomes Billy Ray Valentine is the name of the character, once he like becomes a successful banker, he like immediately realized, oh, he's the smartest person in this movie. And Eddie Murphy plays that just as well because he's so freakishly talented and was at this point just the most talented comedian in the world. And I think still, even with Mr. Church or whatever the name of that movie was and some of the weird decisions that he's made, there are times where you'll have a moment where you're like, oh, right, Eddie Murphy is one of the most talented humans in the world. And this is when he was first really kind of rocketed into that world. That is something I very much enjoyed watching this movie. I think Don Ameche makes an incredible racist. He's actually incredibly convincing, like almost worryingly so as a racist. And the last thing before I let you toss over to you, Jamie Lee Curtis, this was right after this is after Halloween. This was when she was still kind of known as like the schlock movie guys. She is like one of the most cliched characters you could ever come with the movie, the hooker in the Heart of Gold. She is so fun. Like, what a great find she is in this movie. I feel like she adds this extra level of fun and warmth, and she like really leaps off the screen in a way that like you can see that she was a star in the making. It's fun to watch like Jamie Lee Curtis and especially Eddie Murphy on the way up, and then Dan Aykroyd after he makes Ghostbusters, you can see why like that kind of like Dan Aykroyd is fine in this, but it's definitely there's so much talent popping off from those guys, and that I found myself less interested in the things the movie told me I was supposed to be interested in, and more interested in watching those guys. So, Grierson, what did you think of Trading Places other than that? Then I know you obviously loved the blackface scene.
no reference to Al Franken's brilliant performance.
Yes, yes, stoned Al Franken. Stoned Al Franken. Stoned Center Al Franken.
Our reviewer who gave us such a nice 5-star review mentioned the fact that, yeah, 80s comedies can sometimes be a problem for us. Oh boy, this movie. It's like, again, you said it, so I don't want to kind of be redundant. There are lots of 80s comedies I did not see at the time. I feel like that's always important to stress because I come to these movies, like I had seen parts of Trading Places on TV, I'd seen the ending a bunch of times, but I hadn't seen it from beginning to end. So I do really kind of come to these movies like an alien, like trying to study like the 1980s. I always walk away thinking, God, the 80s were as terrible as everybody told me they were. I mean, I lived through them. I was a child, so I kind of remember them. But you watch these movies, and I'm just like, I laughed earlier when you said about, you know, the question that we got about, you know, if we wanted to reboot a movie or remake a movie. That was exactly what I was going to say. I was thinking, because I was actually thinking, like, if you made this movie like a dark, like 12 episode HBO series, what would that look like? Like, you know, I was thinking, like, you could do like David Fincher's The Game, sort of, and do it kind of that way, and it'd be really kind of bleak and horrible. And you wouldn't have to do it in the future. You could just do it right now and make that like a reality that this type of thing kind of goes on in terms of the wealthy doing these types of social experiments. And then I realized I wasn't paying attention to the movie because it just wasn't holding my interest very much. I agree that Eddie Murphy is such an obvious talent, but I mean, I'm sorry. That character, I get that he is doing his thing within that character, but that character is incredibly offensive. He's incredibly offended because the movie is not smart enough to say, oh, we are setting him up to seem like, to use the term that they use a lot in the movie, like a character from the ghetto. But the movie is not smart enough to make us realize that it's subverting that. It just basically says like, okay, Eddie Murphy, just do like your ghetto thing. And he does it very, very well. He's very funny, but that's the character. And so like later when he becomes like the smart guy, you watch about unconvincing scenes where you go, oh, people know a lot about like how pork bellies and that stuff work. All of that stuff is completely stupid in this movie. And I get that it's a comedy, but I kept thinking I'm not convinced that the Eddie Murphy character knows what he's talking about. Like that makes no sense.
You know, there's one that works. There's a scene where like they're explaining their business to him, and he's like, "Oh, you're a bookie." Like yes. You take a little bit of like that scene yes. works.
That scene
actually
works.
And that's where I thought it was going. But then when all of a sudden he's just spouting off details about pork bellies, I'm like, oh no, this movie's not going in that direction.
Because Will and I grew up in Illinois, I always bond with other people from Illinois about pork bellies, because when you grow up in Illinois, you hear about pork bellies a lot. And I actually thought this was like a big commodity that like power brokers traded in, and realized as a grown up that no, that's actually not correct. At all. That's not actually not a thing. I think the ending of this movie is actually kind of fascinating, and I will own up to the fact that I am simply not smart enough to understand exactly what happens at the end of this movie. Like, can you explain to me like what the plan is when they're on the trading floor and how that works? Because I confess, I'm like, wait, what just happened? How did their plan work? How did they make Don Ameche and what's his face go completely bankrupt? Ralph Bellamy. How did that work?
Yeah, and also it's funny because again, I think I agree with everything you've said about the movie. I still feel like it hums along on its level perfectly fine, to be honest. And I can see there are times where I'm like, I can see why this was a hit, because it's not a terrible idea for a movie. It's got Eddie Murphy on his way up, and it's a very high concept, easy kind of thing. And I think it generally rolls along well enough. But the movie screeches to such a halt during the train scene. Like, to me, the you talk about the Al Franken part. Like, it turns from a movie that is occasionally touching on some sort of social satire and that touches on this kind of idea. And then all of a sudden, we're in some ridiculous farce where everyone's dressed up in crazy accents and has a terrible plan that falls apart immediately. and then the blackface happened. I'm like, ah, please stop. But it's weird because, you know, obviously this is not long after both of these people. I think Murphy was on Saturday Night Live at the time, and Dan Aykroyd had just been from Saturday Night Live. And it's fun, had just been on Saturday Night Live. And it's funny how, like, the movie seems like, whatever you think of the characters, they're playing characters for the first, like, three quarters of the movie. And then the train scene happens. Like, why are they, like, it feels like a Saturday Night Live sketch has wandered into this movie in a pretty offensive way. And to me, that's when the movie really starts to fall apart, is during that train sequence. And then they have the moment at the end. And it's funny, because I do think there are moments, again, I can see why it was a hit, and there's stuff that works. I think Denholm Elliott is pretty good. I feel like the Duke, Bellamy and Amici are great as like those evil bad guys. And I can see why people who have not seen this movie in a long time remember it fondly from their youth in a way that I could not see that in, say, Fletch. I could not see that from Fletch, but I could see that here. Like, I watched Fletch being like, okay, good Lord, how did anybody ever like this movie? I can understand in the broad outlines why people like Trading Places. I think it has not aged very well, but I can see why at the time there are moments where, like, people were into this movie, if most of them just being provided by Eddie Murphy. Maybe it's because I like Eddie Murphy, but 1,000 times more than I like Chevy Chase. But I feel like the movie completely collapses into madness by the end.
Now, you did not mention the gorilla sodomy scene, though.
Yes, with Jim Belushi. It's funny because also you can tell that Jim Belushi, because it's so soon after the death of John Belushi, they're like, maybe he could do that because he's like a party guy the way that John Belushi was. But Jim Belushi, as it turns out, not, in fact, like John Belushi.
No. There's like, you know, and again, not to be this way, but I'm going to be this way. You know, like, the offense of gay humor in this movie is really, really irritating. It's really upsetting. I do think Jamie Lee Curtis is really great. I'm immensely impressed with John Landis's ability to get bare breasts into the movies at different parts. I actually watched this movie with my wife, and we were like cheering every time like naked breasts show up, like, because it's such an innovative way. Like, we were not old enough, Will, to go to these types of parties in the 80s, but apparently women just took off their tops all the time at these parties when they weren't, like, you know, doing drugs, when they weren't smoking marijuana joints.
Yes. When just, you know, the song is really good, you have to take your shirt off.
Yeah, that's people want to know how the world has changed since the 80s. That would be one of them. Song has been good enough that women just take off their tops spontaneously. It's a way that we become poorer as a society. I'm being somewhat harsh on this movie because the things I think are bad in this movie just make me just kind of recoil. In a way that makes me feel like people of our age who kind of grew up loving these movies, I want to say, no, seriously, you should rewatch these because they're actually not good. I am actually firmly behind the idea of a dark, serious remake of this film, because I'd be kind of fascinated to see how they do it. But this movie is about the same length as Memento. It's about 5 times longer to get through, I have to say. But yeah,
I will confess, I like this more than Fletch and Weekend at Bernie's. I do like it more than both of those movies.
Yes, I will also claim that, and I will say that it didn't much matter for me. It was, yeah, no, I agree. This is not Fletch level terrible. It's not Weekend at Bernie's level terrible. But you know, the thing, in quotes, works fine, but yeah.
Good God. I in all honesty, it was late at night, and my wife was asleep in the next room, and I was afraid I woke her up. When Dan Aykroyd walked in blackface, I felt like I was afraid someone was watching me. I slammed the screen. If I'm watching a movie on a plane and all of a sudden there's like a hardcore sex scene, I'm like, ah! And like wanted to slam, because it really was... It was quite mortifying. I really, yes. Like, instantly, I was like, yeah, this movie's not very good. It's not very good, but I can see why people liked it. And, ah! Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Nobody told me that was happening.
Yes, but if you want to see an early movie from the great Giancarlo Esposito.
Yes.
He's in this. He's in this movie, yeah.
He does. He hops up briefly as another guy in jail. All right, so that is, it's young Gus Fring before he learned.
By the way, this is the 80s in a nutshell. Everybody just wanted to ride in a limousine. That was the thing. If you were in a limousine, that meant you had made it.
I gotta ask my friends. I gotta tell you, I don't think, like, I know some, I mean, you know, I lived in New York. I know some, like, high rollers. I know some rich people. I don't know any that have a butler. Like, I just don't think that that's like a thing.
Well, you could afford it in Philadelphia. In New York, it'd be a little tougher.
That's true. When you're the 6th borough, as Philadelphia is.
Who should we get to play the butler? Who is that guy in Raiders of the Lost Ark? Could he do that? Yes. And I agree. I think Elliot is I think he's fun in the movie. And,
yeah, I did like that idea though. Like, we're in Manhattan. Okay, we need to, like, it's getting really expensive here. Maybe we'll go to Philadelphia. We can have a butler. We can have a live-in butler. Oh, boy. All right, so that is
yes. Trading Places. By the way, I feel bad for his Dan Aykroyd's original girlfriend, who apparently is just, like, personality-free. You ought to have a thankless role. That's a pretty thankless role in this movie.
Well, I mean, it's pretty thankless to have to pretend to, you know, be in love with Dan Aykroyd in the first place. But anyway, not today. I mean, now. I mean, obviously, who wouldn't be? All right, so that is Trading Places. Keep giving us 80s movies. Eventually, I think we're going to like one. I'm looking forward to the one, like, no one's given us Ferris Bueller. That's one I'd be very curious to go back onto this one. Like, some of these particularly well-regarded ones. But, like, there's a little part of me that's like, oh, my God, what if we see Say Anything and it's horrible? Like, there's all sorts of things that,
we both love Ghostbusters. We're big Ghostbusters. We love Ghostbusters, yeah.
Yeah, speaking of movies that they should reboot. Anyway, all right, so that is Trading Places. That is our reboot section. Okay, so next week, Grierson, next week. Now, there's no major releases next week. There's no major releases, unless you want to, I don't have anything I really particularly, there's no big movies I feel like we need to talk about. There's three big ones coming the week after that. But, so we don't have any major releases to talk about. We'll have two reboot movies. But one thing I'm going to do next week, and I'm curious if anyone has any thoughts on what movies that they would want to contribute to this conversation. This is now the third week in a row, and I think maybe, like, pretty much ever since the election, there's been some sort of, I don't know a lot of people that haven't had the what's happened at the election be like some sort of, like, family tragedy that any conversation you have, you see how long you can go into the conversation before it inevitably comes up. It is a cloud over all of our heads. So I thought it might be fun, Grierson. Fun, perhaps not being the best word for this, but I thought it might be worthwhile to us next week. I want to have a discussion about movies that I think for us or for the listeners are kind of vital or important or speak to our current cultural and political moment. So I think that would be kind of a fun idea to for us to sit down and, like, you come up with three movies and I'll come up with three movies that, like, whether they're about the political aspect or the social aspect or a protest aspect or fascism or whatever you think. I think this would be a fun thing that we should contribute to the conversation while there's a down week in the release schedule. I thought it might be kind of a good thing for us to sit down and chat about.
Yes, I'm thinking about my movies right now, actually. So yeah, if for no other reason, I think it's a helpful way of getting around.
Yes.
talking about what's going on is actually thinking about through the prism of different movies. So I'm down. Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to do that next week. So if you, the listener or the listeners, I think I'm assuming there's more than one, though. Who knows? I don't look at the numbers. Maybe there's just one guy. it's totally a guy too. So anyway, so if you want to send us either on Twitter at Grierson Leach, GRIERSONLEITCH, or email us, GriersonLeach@NewRepublic.com, movies that you think speak to you at this moment, for whatever reason, we'd be curious to chat about that. So that's one of the things we're going to talk about on the podcast next week. We also have two reboot movies. The first is, drumroll please, Michael Clayton, came out in 2007, written and directed by Tony Gilroy, starring George Clooney, Tom Wilkinson, Tilda Swinton, and the late Sydney Pollack. And our second reboot movie came out just last year. It is Other People, written and directed by Chris Kelly, starring Molly Shannon, Jesse Plemons, Maude Apatow, Bradley Whitford, and Zach Woods. That came out last year. I have to say, that was a movie that fell through the cracks for me last year. I did not actually get to see that. I've heard a lot of good things about it. But I'm glad to be able to have the opportunity because I have some close friends that are very fond of that movie. So I'm excited to finally get to see it.
Yeah, that was actually the opening night film of Sundance 2016. I saw it then and I haven't seen it since. So I'm actually very curious to revisit it.
There are people that are really, really into that movie. So I'm excited to talk about that. So next week we'll be talking about movies for our cultural moment, assuming our culture is in fact still around next week, fingers crossed. And we'll talk about Other People and Michael Clayton. Grierson, good show, as always. You nailed it. Every week, I'm only barely here. I've been playing solitaire throughout this entire conversation, but you carried us as you always do.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that neither of our reboot movies have blackface in them. I'm pretty sure they don't for next week, but...
I feel like someone would have said something about other people.
No, I feel pretty confident that it's not the case. Dan Aykroyd, he's not only in blackface, Will. He's playing like a Rastafarian, I think. I think that's what he was doing. It's they were playing with racial stereotypes, you see.
That would be a theory.
Did you get it? That's what they were.
Seriously, I just had to wash my screen, my eyes. I had to like wipe down the walls. It was just terrifying. Anyway, regardless. All right, I'm just glad I wasn't on a plane when I was watching that movie. All right, have a wonderful week, everyone. We will be back, hopefully, next week to discuss all of those movies and the world that we now live in. Grierson, have a good week. Talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.